Menendez gets indicted at the end of the Obama administration. He goes to trial. And because the Supreme Court has so defined down public corruption and bribery, that case ends in a mistrial and the Justice Department ultimately drops the charges. However, it was clear that there was a lot unseemly going on in that first case, very similar in terms of taking trips and getting gifts and things like that in exchange for some actions on behalf of the individual who was alleged to have bribed him. Despite the fact that the Senate Ethics Committee wrote a report that admonished him, said he failed to disclose these gifts, that violated the law, Democrats allowed Menendez to get back into that ranking position on the Foreign Relations Committee, where he was in a position to help with military aid, with arms sales to the Egyptian government. And literally right after he is restored
to that
seat.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, an effort to end hunger in Oregon and across the country. The rest of the nation is looking at Oregon as a model for how to get a handle on plastics pollution. And did Measure 110 really lead to more drug-related deaths? What the CDC now says about that. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 28th, 2023. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. People who support the idea of decriminalizing drugs may have just gotten a boost from new results of a CDC study about a new Oregon law. KBOO's Michelle Coppola has the latest.
The Centers for Disease Control has found that there is no link between Measure 110, Oregon's drug decriminalization law, and the rising number of deaths from drug overdose. In a study published yesterday, data gathered between February of 2021 and March of 2022 showed that overdose deaths were no higher in states with decriminalization laws than in those without those laws. Oregon became the first state in the nation to decriminalize the possession of all drugs when voters passed Measure 110 in 2020. Instead, those caught with small amounts of drugs are referred for treatment rather than being sent to jail. Washington is the only other state in the country to have enacted a similar law. The Portland Mercury reports that the study, which was funded by the CDC, did find that fatal overdoses were up in Oregon, but that such deaths are increasing at relatively the same rate everywhere. While critics of Measure 110 contend that it is to blame for a rise in public drug use and overdoses, CDC researchers instead found, quote, no evidence of an association between legal changes that removed or substantially reduced criminal penalties and fatal drug overdose rates. This also means that those hoping for a reduction in drug use and overdoses as a result of the passage of Measure 110 cannot point to any improvement since it was enacted. A new group focused on repealing key elements of Measure 110 has been formed and announced last week that they have raised more than $700,000 in donations toward that effort. The Coalition to Fix and Improve Ballot Measure 110 aims to recriminalize possession of heroin, methamphetamine, and fentanyl, as well as public drug use. I'm Michelle Coppola for KBOO News.
Federal programs such as SNAP are critical to fighting hunger. As Hunger Action Month comes to an end, some say it's time to expand SNAP. Eric Tegedoff talked to Sammy Teo with the Oregon Food Bank.
Hunger Action Month is coming to a close, but one major action for ensuring people are fed remains on the horizon. The largest federal food assistance program in the country, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, is funded through the Farm Bill, which is up for renewal in Congress. More than 736,000 Oregonians participated in the program, as of the latest numbers from June. Sammy Teo with Oregon Food Bank says members of Congress should not only protect SNAP and the Farm Bill, but make the program better.
Which is expanding it, making sure that it is sustainably funded, supporting programs like the Double Up Food Bucks, which matches $1 for SNAP on things like local fruits and vegetables and veggie starts.
Oregon Food Bank has started a petition to support protecting and expanding SNAP. Teo notes it's critical to fighting hunger across the nation. Teo says the root causes of hunger are systemic, and that means the solutions should be systemic as well.
We know we can't truly end hunger through food banking alone. We have to take action to prevent hunger from happening in the first place. That means addressing the policies and systems that perpetuate hunger and poverty in our communities.
Teo says Oregon lawmakers also are helping to fight hunger. This year, they created the Oregon Kids Tax Credit. The program created a $1,000 tax credit for each child from birth to age 5 for families earning $30,000 or less. About 55,000 Oregon children will benefit from it. For Oregon News Service, this is Eric Tegedoff.
Oregon's first statewide bottle recycling program in the nation got some attention in the nation's capital today. Oregon U.S. Senator Jeff Merkley chaired a subcommittee hearing about improving the collection of single-use beverage containers, and he called on an expert from Oregon, Jules Bailey, the president and CEO of the Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative.
We're a cooperative composed of Oregon beverage distributors, and we're responsible for all aspects of the Oregon program, from handling the deposits and refunds to operating redemption centers to trucking, processing, and even marketing the material. Our vision is a world where no resource is wasted. Beverage containers aren't waste. The glass, plastic, and metal materials that compose the packaging and even the containers themselves, in the case of refillable bottles, are resources that can be used again and again. You can see in this excerpt from our 2022 annual report, we're pretty good at what we do. The bottom line is we have a better redemption rate than any other system. We operate at the lowest cost per container in the United States and maybe the world. And we offer some of the most convenient return options of any program. Last year, we turned over 2 billion glass, metal, and plastic beverage containers into grade A, high quality recyclable material, offsetting not only virgin material, but also producing the kinds of materials that are put into the global market by Russia and China. We also run the nation's only statewide refillable bottle program with nearly 3 times more bottles in circulation than the system in Paris, France. And we're not done yet. We continue to expand access, and our flagship, the Green Bag Account Program, now has over 1 million signups in a state with only 1.5 million households. We have more than 5,600 nonprofits signed up in our state, which received nearly $6 million last year for organizations ranging from wildland firefighting to preschools to homeless shelters and everything in between. So how'd it happen? Oregon, as Senator mentioned, had the first bottle bill in the nation in 1971, and the legislature didn't have a roadmap. So instead, it set the refund value of the container and assigned responsibilities. The legislature asked the beverage distributors to figure out the rest, and over time, they did. The term extended producer responsibility, or EPR, has recently come into fashion, and yet while no one in 1971 would have understood that term, Oregon's bottle bill was really the nation's first EPR program. We're now implementing EPR for other kinds of packaging, but that remains distinct and separate from the DRS. The primary feature of Oregon's deposit return system is that industry is responsible for all costs and all benefits of the program, with 4 fundamental principles. 1, industry pays for all aspects of the program and accepts no public funding. 2, industry invests unclaimed refunds above the target redemption rate into operating and improving the system. 3, industry keeps the scrap material, allowing for full material circularity. And 4, no handling fee exists in Oregon, which allows OBRC to be a central system operator at scale. We've evolved into this over 50 years, and Senator Merkley, when he was still Speaker of the House, Jeff Merkley, shepherded a major set of reforms that expanded Oregon's bottle bill and allowed industry to coordinate as a cooperative, creating OBRC as we know it. But ultimately, there are only 2 things that affect whether a bottle bill is successful: convenience and incentive. A system with high incentives will fail if there is no convenience, but likewise, the most convenient system in the world will fail without an incentive. Curbside recycling is just such a system, and the highest performing curbside systems fail to get back more than around 40% of beverage material, and often much less, and the quality is usually lower. Even if the quality increases, without an incentive, it won't be enough volume to supply the needs of the American recycling infrastructure, like the new aluminum plants being built in the South. So how do we do convenience? First, Oregon law created room for innovation by allowing industry to work out the details in the private market. In Oregon, government regulators act more like referees than coaches or players on the field. Second, OBRC created a strategy for customer segmentation, allowing for return pathways that make sense for different users. We have fast, high-volume return options for those that want cash. For others, the green bag program means families can just place glass, plastic, and metal containers in the same bag and drop them off at a redemption center or store when they go do their shopping. Most Oregonians use this method. Still, others are motivated to redeem containers for their local charity, church, or school. And third, OBRC makes it easy for you to use your money. We have an app that allows you to use Venmo, PayPal, bank-to-bank transfer to move your money. You can donate your balance to a nonprofit or connect it to a kid's 529 college savings plan or even spend it for in-store credit with a 20% bonus. None of these innovations were mandated. Rather, the flexible structure of Oregon's deposit return law allowed them to happen. But at the end of the day, the most important statistic is our customers. Do they like it? People are voting with their feet. This is the whole system summed up in one graph. You can see a dozen years ago, 90% of returns went directly back to large grocery stores with only a billion containers redeemed, and a lot more unclaimed refunds compared to the number of containers processed. As the refund value changed from a nickel to a dime, we expanded to cover nearly all beverage types and invested in convenience and access. Now, nearly 80% of returns come directly back to us, and we're doing twice as much volume directly through our network with a fraction of the unclaimed refunds. And it's popular. 94% of Oregonians are familiar with our deposit return system. 97% of those say it's good for Oregon. And in fact, when we look at the crosstabs, our strongest supporters are consistently older, rural, and Republican. We enjoy broad bipartisan support in the legislature, and we take that responsibility to steward that goodwill very seriously. So as you examine a national deposit return system, we should look at the principles of the Oregon model. We've had 50 years to build the program, and not every state will look the same. But the principles of government facilitation over regulation, empowerment of the private sector to do what it does best in service of public goals, that should be at the heart of a national system. It won't be one size fits all, and we'll need to allow for successful statewide systems to continue operating. But the benefits of a national framework are large. Fewer cross-border issues, more recyclable material at higher quality to build American industry and jobs, and the opportunity to do reusable packaging at scale. So let's make sure that in America, no resource goes to waste.
And that was some of the testimony today before the U.S. Senate from Jules Bailey, the president and CEO of the Oregon Beverage Recycling Cooperative. The Multnomah County Animal Shelter now has a work plan for improvement. KBOO's Michelle Coppola has more on that story.
According to a presentation from Multnomah County Animal Services Management to the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners this past Tuesday, the animal shelter in Troutdale now has a work plan to address ongoing issues of mismanagement and poor animal care that have plagued the shelter for years. Shelter leaders, including Director of Animal Services Aaron Grayheck, outlined more than 100 recommendations for improving shelter operations and animal care in what they called a strategic work plan that will be implemented over the next 15 months. The work plan was developed as a result of an ongoing 9-month review of the shelter that was ordered by Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson last January, when the shelter was forced to shut down because of overcrowding and a lack of staffing. Part of the review included gathering community input about the shelter. Grayheck told the commissioners that based on the feedback from that survey and results from the review, they have developed 5 priorities for the shelter moving forward.
The priorities that we identified based on all areas of feedback are safety and well-being of pets in our care. Our staff and our volunteers live this value every day. Policy and procedure standardization and accountability. This will include updating current policy and procedures, training and accountability to our community, volunteer management, hiring and onboarding, as well as right-sizing staff with identifiable methodology, making sure that we have the right combination of people to meet our organizational goals. We are dedicated to culture change management and transparency. Managing our culture with transparency, equity, and inclusion is a primary success factor in all our current and future work. Another area is facilities and plant improvements and plans. We're exploring what can we do with our existing facilities. Are we as safe and approachable as we can possibly be. And finally, we want to focus on data integrity and quality analysis. Data and quality analysis will be used to guide all of our decision making with a goal for moving us to a reactive organization to a proactive organization.
That was Director of Multnomah County Animal Services, Aaron Grayheck. Serious problems at the shelter, including the failure to meet national standards for animal care, have been well known for at least 7 years. But despite audits and outcries from local animal welfare advocates, those issues were not adequately addressed by previous shelter management or the County Board of Commissioners. For KABU News, I'm Michelle Coppola.
As the auto worker strike continues, elected officials say it's time to get on board with the EPA's proposed clean car standards. Vera Siddiqui has that story.
Gary Schack, a city council member in Allen Park, Michigan, supports the UAW workers in their quest for contracts that align with their skills, dedication, and loyalty. He says the state's automakers are committed to increasing the production of zero-emission vehicles in the next decade and intend to leverage the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act to do so.
It's time for Ford, GM, and Chrysler's parent company, Stellantis, to come to the table. EV vehicles, and with these EPA standards put in place, these workers are concerned that these jobs, if they go non-union, competitive wages will fall.
The Energy Department predicts EV battery manufacturing will support 10 to 13 million fully electric vehicles annually by 2030. Michigan, Georgia, Kentucky, Kansas, North Carolina, Ohio, and Tennessee are key players in this growth, fueling job opportunities across the sector. Bara Siddiqui reporting.
A new report shows hundreds of violations and plenty of pollution from Idaho's sewage treatment plants. Eric Tegedoff reports.
More than half of the sewage facilities in Idaho had pollution violations in 2022. The sixth annual analysis by the Idaho Conservation League says 57% of the state's wastewater treatment plants discharged harmful substances last year. Will Tiedemann with the Idaho Conservation League says the report focuses on facilities that had the potential to cause the most harm, such as those releasing wastewater in sensitive habitats. He says size has had an impact on those violations in recent years.
There's quite a few facilities that are a little smaller, and they do deal with outdated equipment. It's either failed, you know, it was built 20, 30, 40 years ago.
Collectively, there were 520 violations of the Clean Water Act by Idaho wastewater treatment plants in 2022. The report focuses on three facilities that accounted for a quarter of the violations in Driggs, Jerome, and Kuna. Tiedemann notes there are some positives in this report. Facilities in 51 cities and towns reported no discharge violations. Others made significant improvements from 2021 to 2022, including those in Blackfoot, Marsing, and Wilder.
This isn't an insurmountable issue. There are numerous examples of facilities who have dealt with issues and have made the investments and put in the resources and the time and the hard work to address those issues. So we definitely commend those facilities.
Tiedemann says having the means to curtail violations can be a major issue, especially for smaller towns. But he says federal resources are available, including through COVID-19 relief funds.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KABU Evening News. Our goal is to raise $55,000 by the end of October. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KABU membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kabu.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for KABU News In Depth. We've got a special interview with Street Roots about their recent article on Kaiser Permanente pharmacy workers voting to strike. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, cloudy, a low down to 51 overnight. Tomorrow's weather, clouds continue. A slight chance of rain, a high of 63. Today in history, on this date in 1965, 6 years after he led the Cuban Revolution, Fidel Castro announced that any Cuban who wished to leave the island was free to do so. In the next 8 years, about 300,000 left the island and headed toward Miami. The quote of the day is from Fidel Castro. No thieves, no traitors, no interventionists. This time, the revolution is for real. Senate leaders advance a plan trying to avoid a government shutdown. An elections official argues that artificial intelligence could be a threat to democracy. And voting rights supporters look to states like Arizona to rally young Latinx voters. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2023 Talks.
Though the bill doesn't have everything either side wants, It's a bridge CR. That's what we call it, a bridge. A bridge to getting the things we do want in November.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says the Senate will pass bipartisan stopgap funding, even if the Republican-led House can't. Action in the House continues to be blocked by a handful of hard-right members, but senators from both parties have agreed to fund the government at current levels until November 17th. Senate Republican Leader Mitch McConnell supports the bill, but declines to say if he wants to strip out the additional aid for Ukraine it contains. McConnell did send a pointed rebuke to Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy.
A vote against a standard short-term funding measure is a vote against paying over $1 billion in salary for Border Patrol and ICE agents.
Willie Joe Price is a cafeteria worker at the Library of Congress, one of many federal workers who could lose their paychecks. She tells ABC News she had to take out a loan during the last government shutdown 5 years ago.
I've been up on this hill for 42 years. I've been there.
Former President Donald Trump is calling out Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro for putting in automatic voter registration. Trump called that a totally unconstitutional act in a post on Truth Social. Promoting a new book that describes a reckless and chaotic White House, former Trump aide Cassidy Hutchison says she'll cooperate with criminal investigations into Trump if asked.
I stand by everything I testified to the January 6th committee, to the Department of Justice, to Fulton County investigators, and I stand by everything that's in this book.
The second GOP debate took place in Simi Valley, California, with Trump again notably absent. The former president was in Michigan giving a speech to non-union auto workers. Former Federal Elections Commission's chair, Trevor Potter, testified to a Senate committee that artificial intelligence could be a real threat to democracy.
Unchecked, the deceptive use of AI could make it virtually impossible to determine who is truly speaking in a political communication, whether the message being communicated is authentic, or even whether something being depicted actually happened.
Potter argues AI could make it easier for foreign actors to manipulate elections. States with high Latino populations like Arizona were crucial in 2020 and 2022. The president of Voto Latino, Maria Teresa Colmar, says her organization is focusing on young Latinos, who she says have the biggest potential to bring change in upcoming elections.
We're expecting 163,000 Latino youth to turn 18 in that state alone. The tsunami is just beginning.
I'm Alex Gonzalez.
Two camps set up in Winnipeg draw attention to missing and murdered Indigenous people. And the Black and Native maternal death rate is up over the past 20 years. With these stories and more, here's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
Indigenous people in Winnipeg are continuing to raise concerns and call on officials to search landfills for their missing and murdered relatives. Among the Indigenous women they want found and brought home are Morgan Harris, 39, and Mercedes Myron, 26. Police believe the women are victims of an alleged serial killer and that the remains could be in a landfill. Two camps have been set up in efforts to keep pressure on officials and draw awareness to missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, Two-Spirit, and gender-diverse people.
So there's Cat Morgan and Cat Mercedes.
On an August morning, firekeeper Shining Gold Star, who lives in Winnipeg, talks about Camp Mercedes, named after Mercedes Myron. He's been there since it was first set up in July in the city next to the Canadian Museum for Human Rights.
It's to honor the missing and murdered, especially in the landfill. It focuses on search the landfill.
Gold Star walks around the camp where there are a handful of tents and a camp kitchen. Signs are posted all around. Some read, "We are not garbage. Search the landfills and no more stolen sisters." There are red handprints and art drawn on sidewalks and benches along walking paths near a river and park. There are also a number of empty red dresses displayed, symbolizing those who've gone missing and murdered.
The government does not want to look because not only is there in there, but there's other people in there. They don't want to, they're going to have to explain things. I've had people come up to me with shovels from every community, Black, white, and blue, and they all said the same thing. We'll do it.
A more than 30-minute drive from Camp Mercedes is the city-operated Brady Landfill, where distress flags fly at Camp Morgan, named after Morgan Harris. There are also red dresses positioned around the camp, tents, a wigwam, and teepees. Some people say they've been there since December, while others, like Ida Manuel from British Columbia, felt compelled to come here this summer.
My heart going out to the families affected and just
had to answer that call.
Remains of Rebecca Cantois, 24, another victim, were found at Brady last year. A blockade at the road leading up to the landfill had previously been set up, but was dismantled. Now, dumping continues.
For us to have to stand and say, you know, we are not trash, and still not be heard, you know, it really needs to be connected. Canada's lack of respect with what colonialism set out to do to Indigenous.
The other landfill, Prairie Green, is privately operated outside of Winnipeg. The Manitoba government is citing costs and health and safety concerns for not conducting a search at Prairie Green for Harris and Myron. Advocates say they're prepared to camp through the winter. They're also hoping new leadership of the province will be elected in October to offer assistance. Last year, Jeremy Sabicki, 35 at the time, was charged for the murder of the three women and a fourth unidentified woman. The overall number of maternal deaths nationwide rose from more than 500 to more than 1,200. That's according to a recent study in the Journal of the American Medical Association. Black and American Indian and Alaska Native mothers had the highest number of deaths per 100,000 live births. The rate for Black moms rose from about 27 to 55. The American Indian and Alaska Native rate rose from 14 to about 49. Health experts say many factors play into these numbers, including lack of services. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A variety of educational, medical, and support groups are emphasizing the need to address bullying, especially with social media being so pervasive. Mike Moen has more on that story.
This weekend marks the kickoff of National Bullying Prevention Month. Those raising awareness hope schools work toward establishing a more inclusive environment and that parents take action when needed. According to the Midwest-based PACER organization, one in five students report being bullied, and being targeted can directly affect their ability to learn. Julie Herzog leads PACER's National Bullying Prevention Center and says schools are being more proactive with anti-bullying messaging, but she adds they can take it a step further by fostering more unity within their buildings.
It can be as simple as if you're doing an activity within a group, asking somebody else if they would like to join you or participate. So any way that you can increase connection between each other makes communities healthier for everyone.
Herzog notes that social media remains a concern in trying to protect kids from hurtful actions by their peers. Whether a student is bullied online or at school, she says parents should let the child talk openly about it and how they feel about responding. She also advises them to research the school's harassment policy for guidance on how to proceed. Herzog says over time, their work has helped dispel myths that words can't hurt people and that experiencing bullying is part of growing up. She says a lot of kids know this behavior is not okay. But she stresses a lot of students are still likely to feel isolated, and recognizing them in a positive way is important.
We talk a lot about the tenets of kindness, accepting each other for our differences.
LGBTQ advocates have argued those sentiments are especially important in conservative-led states, which have passed various laws deemed hostile towards transgender students. According to the Trevor Project, 52% of LGBTQ youth enrolled in middle or high school report being bullied either in person or electronically. This is Mike Moen.
Republican lawmakers have introduced 40 bills in states across the country targeting colleges and universities trying to end DEI or diversity, equity, and inclusion trainings. But now, as Eric Galatis reports, a college in Colorado is fighting back, offering a safe haven for students who want to leave states that no longer back DEI.
In a growing backlash since the nation was rocked by the murder of George Floyd by Minneapolis police, five states have now passed anti-diversity, equity, and inclusion laws targeting colleges and universities: Florida, North Carolina, North Dakota, Tennessee, and Texas. Rosalie Rodriguez with Colorado College says for the next two academic years, students from these states can transfer and find a safe haven on their Colorado Springs campus.
None of us learns well in an environment where we are feeling unsafe, we're feeling harmed, we're feeling oppressed, we're feeling scared. We do not perform at our best when we are under threat.
Republican lawmakers have introduced 40 bills since 2022 in an effort to end practices, including DEI trainings and classes that deal with systemic racism, sexism, oppression, and privilege. The bills Proponents say these concepts distort historical events and promote identity politics. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has said DEI should stand for discrimination, exclusion, and indoctrination. Many worry the new laws could lead to a climate of uncertainty, fear, and even violence. Rodriguez says the Haven Initiative is a response to an immediate need for those in harm's way. She adds the program removes many barriers transfer students typically face.
So all of the students who are applying through the Haven Initiative will get their full financial need met in their tuition package. We are also making sure that all of their credits transfer. We also will guarantee housing.
Rodriguez is also challenging other colleges and institutions interested in holistically educating students to push back against repressive laws that are in opposition to their values. She points to a salient statement by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In the end, we will remember not the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends.
Because we all know that silence is a voice of complicity, and I think there are many of us who do not want to be complicit in regressing some of the rights that we have worked so hard for over these many years.
This is Eric Galatis.
You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, September 28th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Michelle Coppola, Eric Tagadoff, Eric Galatis, Mike Moen, and Farah Siddiqui. The producer's Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, so now's a great time to join. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In-Depth with an interview on Street Root's recent coverage of Kaiser Permanente pharmacy workers voting to strike.
KBOO News In-Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You're listening to KBOO News In-Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Aurora Biggers, a freelancer with Street Roots, about